This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. As soccer fans worldwide look forward to the 2022 World Cup game in Qatar, Amnesty International has just released a new report finding horrific levels of worker exploitation. Tens of thousands of workers are building a new stadium for the World Cup in Doha called Khalifa International Stadium. And the workforce is almost entirely of migrant origin, hailing from the South Asian countries of Bangladesh, India, and Nepal. Amnesty interviewed hundreds of workers for its report and found widespread abuses and exploitation. The report is entitled The Ugly Side of the Beautiful Game, Exploitation on a Qatar 2022 World Cup Site. Well, joining me now from London is James Lynch. He's the Deputy Director for Middle East and North Africa with Amnesty International. Welcome to the program, James. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, what does the Gulf Arab state of Qatar have planned for the 2022 World Cup? Just so we can get a scope of this project. It's quite ambitious, isn't it?
It's a highly ambitious project. The hosting the World Cup has really been at the center of Qatar's ambitions to position itself as a sporting hub, as a regional hub for the Middle East. It will be the first Middle East state to host a World Cup, and the infrastructure required to deliver a project of this scale is quite unprecedented for Qatar. So, you know, there are a large number of new stadiums being constructed, as well as several being renovated, but there's also a huge road and railway project, a hotel building project. They've just opened a new airport in the last couple of years. This is multi-billion dollars worth of new infrastructure and investment. And of course, that requires a lot of labor to build that infrastructure. And so the population of Qatar has been growing at really a dramatic rate in order to recruit migrant workers to make those projects happen.
Right, because it's a small country, and like many of the other Gulf Arab states in the area, the population of migrants sometimes outnumbers the indigenous population, right?
That's right. In fact, over 90% of the workforce in Qatar are foreign nationals, and the majority of those are from India, Nepal, Bangladesh, Pakistan. So it's South Asia is the kind of key recruitment hotspot for Qatar, as with so many Gulf states, as you say. Those are principally men working in the construction industry. There is also a large population of migrant workers in Qatar from Southeast Asia, who are largely women working as domestic workers in people's homes.
Right, women from the Philippines, et cetera, Malaysia.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah.
So how many workers are working specifically on this World Cup project? You said it's a number of stadiums. Some are being renovated. Some are being built new. So how many workers are we talking about? And is that number expected to go up as we get closer to 2022?
Yeah, at the moment, the number of people working on World Cup stadiums is relatively still small. It's around 4,000, but that I think will rise to around 36,000 in the next year or so. So it will ramp up quite significantly. The numbers working on infrastructure that will help deliver the World Cup is in the hundreds of thousands. So the stadiums themselves are just a small part of the package.
So let's talk about the report. How did Amnesty talk to the workers? I understand rather than focusing on every aspect of this project, because it's a huge project, you focused on one specific stadium. How did you talk to the workers? Because sometimes it's not easy to get access. And how many workers was it that your organization was able to interview?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would just start by saying, in the past few years, we've done a lot of research on the wider situation as well. So in a way, it was at this point we felt it was important to focus on the specific World Cup projects because they've attracted such a lot of interest. In this case, we spoke to around 234 workers, and around 100 of those were directly employed on the Khalifa Stadium that you mentioned in your introduction. It is difficult to meet migrant workers in Qatar. They are often very scared to talk to outsiders. Their employers, the companies in Qatar, tend to be extremely reluctant for them to speak to anyone, you know, perhaps for fear of them speaking about their conditions. And so, you know, the state also has been, you know, very suspicious of outsiders, whether it be journalists or human rights activists, entering migrant worker labor camps or building sites. And we've had, you know, a number of journalists have been arrested and deported in previous years. So we have to be very careful, and we have to, you know, speak to workers in a way that doesn't put them at risk in particular of, you know, being deported or other reprisals that they could face.
So let's talk about the conditions. You mentioned labor camps. I mean, this is something that's a familiar term for people who have studied how migrant labor is treated in the Gulf state. And I should also, by the way, mention that I have a personal connection to this story. I was born and raised in Dubai in the UAE. Yes. My family migrated there for work, and I had an uncle who worked in the construction business. There was one of these workers injured on the job, you know, didn't get any compensation. So I sort of know pretty directly, as directly as one can know without actually being a worker, what these conditions are like. So what are these labor camps like? What are the conditions that the workers live in and work in?
Well, I mean, it ranges, you know, a great deal. But unfortunately, what is far too common to see is, you know, very cramped and squalid living conditions, you know, largely because employers are saving money by renting out spaces that are too small without the proper facilities. The laws in Qatar, as in the UAE, which you obviously have personal experience of, you know, tend to put down, you know, decent standards in terms of what accommodation people should have, but those aren't enforced and companies, you know, largely ignore them. And what we found in this case, you know, with the World Cup stadium, is that some of these workers, you know, had been housed in really squalid living conditions, you know, very cramped conditions, you know, with you know, raw sewage, you know, you know, evident in the surrounding area. This is unfortunately, you know, not uncommon, not unrepresentative. And of course, you know, it's even more disappointing because the Supreme Committee for Delivery and Legacy, who organized the World Cup in Qatar, you know, they actually have very strict standards about what accommodation people should be housed in who are working on their projects, stricter standards than even Qatari law mandates.
And so is it a matter of then enforcing the law? And by the way, who is actually responsible? I mean, is this a project of the Qatar government that they are then subcontracting out to private companies?
Well, there's a lot of layers of responsibility. I mean, ultimately, of course, the state of Qatar, you know, is responsible for human rights within the country. So, you know, the protection that people should be protected from such abuses. The Ministry of Labour is the body within the country who has that responsibility for inspection and for enforcement of the labour laws. You know, it has a poor record. It is only just now in the last couple of years, under severe pressure, increased its number of labour inspectors to, I think there are now 375 of them. But still, that is not enough, given the size of the workforce and how, you know, widespread the abuse and exploitation is. The Supreme Committee, which is the Qatari body that's delivering the World Cup, also has a responsibility, you know, to enforce its own standards and ensure that the contractors and subcontractors, as you mentioned, you know, deliver those standards themselves and properly monitor the conditions on their sites. So the big contractors have a job to do here too, and they, in general, you know, they're not doing it adequately.
And are these contractors international companies? Do they have links to the West?
It depends on the project. I mean, in this case that we documented, the main contractor on the Khalifa Stadium is a joint venture between a Qatari and a Belgian company. The other companies are all locally established Qatari companies. But yes, I mean, certainly we've documented other cases involving Korean, French, and Spanish companies, you know, on other sites. So it's a real mix.
So we talked about the living conditions. Let's talk about issues of freedom of movement. This is an often important issue when we're talking about migrant workforces in Gulf states. Workers are often recruited in their home countries with certain promises, promises of certain types of salary. When they arrive, though, sometimes their passports are confiscated from them. Sometimes the cost of living, even their rent and food is subtracted from their salaries. Can you explore that a little bit? Because some of the examples that we hear of South Asian migrant workers being lured to Gulf Arab states veer dangerously close to the definition of human trafficking.
Absolutely. Deception is very common in both the type of work people are promised and the salary that they'll receive for doing that. And we document both of those cases in this report. Unfortunately, it is very common, very standardized as a way to entice people to migrate. And of course, this comes on top of people paying large fees to recruit. So they make decisions based on the salary that they're told to expect. And when they arrive, you know, in Qatar or in the UAE or other Gulf states, they often find that actually they're not going to earn as much as they thought they were. So their entire basis for their migration is undermined. And that can constitute human trafficking, as you say. It also makes the payment of fees in the home country often, you know, can facilitate forced labor as well, as it can be very easy to tie somebody to their work by saying, well, you have to stay because I know you have these fees to pay off.
So what about then health and safety conditions on the job? We talked about living conditions, about how workers are recruited. Now on the job, are health and safety conditions properly being respected? You know, in the summertime in the Gulf, it can get unbearably hot for sometimes 9 months out of the year. And often workers will get heat stroke. Some might die of heat stroke. Tell us about those conditions.
Well, I mean, the first thing I should say is on this report, we didn't document any specific concerns around health and safety. And that is not to say that they don't exist. It's just simply we didn't document them in this case. Qatar has come under the spotlight for the number of workers who have died in recent years. And those, you know, concerns about the deaths and health and safety of workers tend to fall into two areas. One is injuries on the construction site. And these are far too common. You know, we have previously looked at this issue and there was a very revealing statement made a couple of years back by a senior doctor at the main hospital in Qatar saying that, that they were getting very large numbers of workers who were falling from height and not wearing helmets on their sites, and that in 10% of those cases that was leading to permanent disability and fatality was too high. There's been various academic studies that have shown that the construction fatalities are too high in Qatar when you compare them against, you know, other major, you know, industrial projects, you know, in other countries. The other concern has been around the number of heart attacks, and this has often been connected, you know, to the issue of working in the heat and overly long hours that many workers work for. As I say, this isn't something that came up in this particular piece of research, but again, this is a very major concern. And what's disturbing is that the Qatari government has really never answered these questions and looked into why so many workers, you know, of working age, you know, not elderly people, are dying of heart attacks, which are not explained. And you know, they need to open an investigation into that, an independent investigation, to identify what the causes are and what the solutions, you know, may be, because it is an urgent crisis.
So clearly the Qatar's government bears responsibility. What about the governments of the countries that the workers are from? Are they playing a role? Are they demanding any action for better treatment for their citizens?
Well, I mean, the governments of the sending countries have a great deal that they could be doing. You know, of course, they should be protecting their citizens, you know, through their embassies, but they should also be doing much more to protect them from deception, from the payment of illegal fees in their home countries before migrating. And they should be providing them with the means to get justice. If their rights have been abused when they return home, they should have, you know, avenues to get a remedy for that, to get reparations and compensation for their ordeals. In reality, little of this takes place. you know, there are probably a variety of reasons for that, depending on which country of origin we're talking about. I think in many cases it's clear that what really needs to happen is political pressure from all of the countries of origins working together on the receiving countries to get reform of the kafala system that exists in these countries, and to improve the enforcement of labor laws. Now, the reason that political pressure doesn't happen, one can largely speculate on this, but I imagine that it is to do with the significant proportion of GDP in many cases that are made up by remittances from migrant workers, and the risk that the supply could be cut off by the receiving countries.
So let's can you share any examples from the report that Amnesty did of the experiences of some of these workers? And going through the report, you had quotes from workers who say they basically feel like they're imprisoned in Qatar, that they feel trapped, they feel very exploited. Are there any stories you could share? Because ultimately, we're talking about human beings here. And as we sort of discuss this issue on an abstract level, I think it's important to ground our discussion in what actual living, breathing human beings are going through.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, some of the most shocking cases probably relate to the Nepal earthquake, you know, which happened, you know, in the middle of 2015. You know, obviously, a large number of migrant workers in Qatar are Nepalis, and you know, understandably, many wanted to get back home to either assist their families, you know, if their houses had been destroyed or the village had been damaged, or simply to find relatives who they couldn't contact. And in that case, you know, a number of companies blocked their workers from returning home. They didn't issue them exit permits. And we've spoken to a number of workers, you know, for this report, whose company did just that, you know, said to them, go back to work. You have a contract to fulfill. The company has the passport. The company can issue the exit permit. So the worker just simply has no option. So they were, you know, clearly these men were distraught. And it really brings home how damaging the kafala system can be, you know, and how much it leaves people at the mercy, you know, of their employer, you know, and whether they choose to respect their rights or not.
So, I mean, this entire sort of system, economic system, is built on mostly men being separated from their families in their home countries, who leave because they're desperately poor in their countries and they want to be able to send money back. But when disaster strikes while they're separated, such as the Nepal earthquake, they can't even come back to find their missing loved ones or to take care of that family for whom they left in the first place, to be able to take care of. I mean, it's just sort of broadly speaking, this is just a terrible situation. And all of it, of course, in this case that Amnesty is focusing on, in the service of a very moneyed game. The most watched event, sporting event in the world is the World Cup. People from all over the world watch it. So what should, say, soccer fans be thinking about when they see your report? What do you hope for them?
Well, you know, football fans should really, in this case, you know, and I hope that they will be concerned by what they've heard about, you know, this is the stadium that will host the World Cup semi-final. We would hope that they would start putting pressure on FIFA. FIFA has done very, very little. You know, the world governing body of football has known for 5 years that these abuses are taking place. And yet, what action have we seen from them? Very, very little at all. They should be putting pressure on the Qatari authorities publicly to reform their system, to put in place better protections. And FIFA themselves should be investigating on the ground what's taking place. If Amnesty can find these abuses, why can't FIFA? There is a petition that Amnesty has, you know, calling on FIFA to do the right thing. And you know, I hope some of your viewers may be able to participate in that.
Well, I want to thank you so much, James, for joining us today, and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
We'll post a link to the report at amnesty.org. My guest is James Lynch, Deputy Director for Middle East and North Africa with Amnesty International, joining us from London. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.